chapter 13. Does religion make people behave better? A little more than a century after Joseph Smith fell victim to the violence and mania that he had helped to unleash, another prophetic voice was raised in the United States. A young black pastor named Dr. Martin Luther King began to preach that his people, the descendants of the very slavery that Joseph Smith and all other Christian churches had so warmly approved, should be free. It is quite impossible, even for an atheist like myself, to read his sermons or watch recordings of his speeches without profound emotion of the sort that can sometimes bring genuine tears. Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail, written in response to a group of white Christian clerics who had urged him to show restraint and patience, in other words, to know his place, is a model of polemic. Icily polite and generous-minded, it still breathes with an unquenchable conviction that the filthy injustice of racism must be borne no longer. Taylor Branch's magnificent three-volume biography of Dr. King is successively titled Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge, and the rhetoric with which King addressed his followers was designed to evoke the very story that they all knew best, the one that begins when Moses first tells Pharaoh to let my people go. In speech after speech, he inspired the oppressed and exhorted and shamed their oppressors. Slowly, the embarrassed religious leadership of the country moved to his side. Rabbi Abraham Heschel asked, "Where in America today do we hear a voice like the voice of the prophets of Israel?" Martin Luther King is a sign that God has not forsaken the United States of America. Most eerie of all, if we follow the Mosaic narrative, was the sermon that King gave on the last night of his life. His work of transforming public opinion and shifting the stubborn Kennedy and Johnson administrations was almost done, and he was in Memphis, Tennessee, to support a long and bitter strike by the city's ground-down garbage collectors, on whose placards appeared the simple words, "I am a man." In the pulpit at Mason Temple, he reviewed the protracted struggle of the past years and then very suddenly said, "But it doesn't matter with me now." There was silence until he went on, "Because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and He's allowed me to go up the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. And I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." Nobody who was there that night has ever forgotten it, and I dare say the same can be said for anyone who views the film that was so fortunately taken of that transcendent moment. The next best way of experiencing this feeling at second hand is to listen to how Nina Simone sang, that same terrible week, "The King of Love is Dead." The entire drama has the capacity to unite elements of Moses on Mount Nebo with the agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. The effect is scarcely diminished, even when we discover that this was one of his favourite sermons, and one that he had delivered several times before, and into which he could slip as occasion demanded. But the examples King gave from the books of Moses were, fortunately for all of us, metaphors and allegories. His most imperative preaching was that of non-violence. In his version of the story, there are no savage punishments and genocidal bloodlettings, nor are there cruel commandments about the stoning of children and the burning of witches. His persecuted and despised people were not promised the territory of others, nor were they incited to carry out the pillage and murder of other tribes. In the face of endless provocation and brutality, King beseeched his followers to become what they for a while truly became, the moral tutors of America and of the world beyond its shores. He in effect forgave his murderer in advance. The one detail that would have made his last public words flawless and perfect would have been an actual declaration to that effect. But the difference between him and the prophets of Israel could not possibly have been more marked. If the population had been raised from its mother's knee to hear the story of Xenophon's Anabasis and the long, wearying, dangerous journey of the Greeks to their triumphant view of the sea, that allegory might have done just as well. As it was, though, the good book was the only point of reference that everybody had in common. Christian reformism arose originally from the ability of its advocates to contrast the Old Testament with the New. The cobbled-together ancient Jewish books had an ill-tempered and implacable and bloody and provincial God, who was probably more frightening when he was in a good mood, the classic attribute of the dictator. Whereas the cobbled-together books of the last 2,000 years contained handholds for the hopeful, and references to meekness, forgiveness, lambs and sheep, and so forth. This distinction is more apparent than real, since it is only in the reported observations of Jesus that we find any mention of hell and eternal punishment. The God of Moses would brusquely call for other tribes, including his favourite one, to suffer massacre and plague and even extirpation, but when the grave closed over his victims, he was essentially finished with them, unless he remembered to curse their succeeding progeny. Not until the advent of the Prince of Peace do we hear of the ghastly idea of further punishing and torturing the dead. First presaged by the rantings of John the Baptist, the Son of God is revealed as one who, if his milder words are not accepted straight away, will condemn the inattentive to everlasting fire. This has provided texts for clerical sadists ever since, and features very lip-smackingly in the tirades of Islam. At no point did Dr. King, who was once photographed in a bookstore, waiting calmly for a physician, while the knife of a maniac was sticking straight out of his chest, even hint that those who injured and reviled him were to be threatened with any revenge or punishment in this world or the next, save the consequences of their own brute selfishness and stupidity. And he even phrased that appeal more courteously than, in my humble opinion, its targets deserved. In no real as opposed to nominal sense, then, was he a Christian. This does not in the least diminish his standing as a great preacher, any more does the fact that he was a mammal like the rest of us, and probably plagiarized his doctoral dissertation, and had a notorious fondness for booze and for women a good deal younger than his wife. He spent the remainder of his last evening in orgiastic dissipation, for which I don't blame him. These things, which of course disturb the faithful, are rather encouraging in that they show that a high moral character is not a precondition for great moral accomplishments. But if his example is to be deployed, as it often is, to show that religion has an uplifting and liberating effect, then let us examine the wider claim. Taking the memorable story of Black America as our instance, we should find first that the enslaved were not captives of some pharaoh, but of several Christian states and societies that for many years operated a triangular trade between the west coast of Africa, the eastern seaboard of North America, and the capitals of Europe. This huge and terrible industry was blessed by all churches and for a long time aroused absolutely no religious protest. Its counterpart, the slave trade in the Mediterranean and North Africa, was explicitly endorsed by and carried out in the name of Islam. In the 18th century, a few dissenting Mennonites and Quakers in America began to call for abolition, as did some free thinkers like Thomas Paine. Thomas Jefferson, ruminating on the way that slavery corrupted and brutalized the masters, as well as exploited and tortured the slaves, wrote, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." This was a statement as incoherent as it is memorable. Given the marvel of a God who was also just, there would be, in the long term, nothing much to tremble about. At any rate, the Almighty managed to tolerate the situation, while several generations were born and died under the lash, and until slavery became less profitable, and even the British Empire began to get rid of it. This was the spur for the revival of abolitionism. It sometimes took a Christian form, most notably in the case of William Lloyd Garrison, the great orator and founder of The Liberator. Mr. Garrison was a splendid man by any standards, but it is probably fortunate that all of his early religious advice was not followed. He based his initial claim on the dangerous verse from Isaiah that calls on the faithful to come out and be separated. This is also the theological basis of Ian Paisley's fundamentalist and bigoted Presbyterianism in Northern Ireland. In Garrison's view, the Union and the United States Constitution were a covenant with death, and ought both to be destroyed. It was, in effect, he who called for secession before the Confederates did. In later life, he discovered the work of Thomas Paine and became less of a preacher and a more effective abolitionist, as well as an early supporter of female suffrage. It was the escaped slave Frederick Douglass, author of the stirring and mordant autobiography, who eschewed apocalyptic language and demanded instead that the United States live up to the universalist promises contained in its Declaration and its Constitution. The lion like John Brown, who also began as a fearsome and pitiless Calvinist, did the same. Later in life he had Paine's works in his camp and admitted freethinkers to his tiny but epoch-changing army, and even produced and printed a new declaration, modelled on that of 1776, on behalf of the enslaved. This was in practice a much more revolutionary as well as a more realistic demand, and prepared the way, as Lincoln admitted, for the Emancipation Proclamation. Douglass was somewhat ambivalent about religion, noting in his autobiography that the most devout Christians made the most savage slaveholders. The obvious truth of this was underlined when secession really did come, and the Confederacy adopted the Latin motto Deo Vindice, or in effect, God on our side. As Lincoln pointed out in his highly ambivalent second inaugural address, both sides in the quarrel made that claim, at least in their pulpits, just as both were addicted to loud, confident quotations from Holy Writ. Lincoln himself was hesitant to claim authority in this manner. In fact, at one point he famously said that such invocations of the divine were wrong, because it was rather a matter of trying to be on God's side. pressed to issue an immediate Emancipation Proclamation at a gathering of Christians in Chicago, he continued to see both sides of the argument as endorsed by faith, and said that these are not, however, the days of miracles, and I suppose it will be granted that I am not to expect a direct revelation. This was neatly evasive, yet when he finally did nerve himself to issue the proclamation, he told the remaining waverers that he had promised himself to do so, on condition that God gave victory to the Union forces at Antietam. On that day, the largest ever number of deaths on United States soil was recorded. So it is possible that Lincoln wanted somehow to sanctify and justify that appalling carnage. This would be a noble enough thing until one reflects that on the same logic, the same carnage decided the other way would have postponed the freeing of the slaves. As he also said, the rebel soldiers are praying with a great deal more earnestness, I fear, than our own troops, and expecting God to favour their side. For one of our soldiers, who had been taken prisoner, said that he met with nothing so discouraging as the evident sincerity of those he was among in their prayers. One more bit of battlefield luck for the grey uniforms at Antietam, and the president might have become worried that God had deserted the anti-slavery cause altogether. We do not know Lincoln's private religious beliefs. He was fond of references to Almighty God, but he never joined any church, and his early candidacies were much opposed by clergymen. His friend Herndon knew that he had read Paine and Volney and other freethinkers very closely, and formed the opinion that he was privately an outright unbeliever. This seems improbable. However, it would also be inaccurate to say that he was a Christian. Much evidence supports the view that he was a tormented skeptic with a tendency to deism. Whatever may be the case, the very most that can be said for religion in the grave matter of abolition is that, after many hundreds of years, and having both imposed and postponed the issue, until self-interest had led to a horrifying war, it finally managed to undo some small part of the damage and misery that it had inflicted in the first place. The same can be said of the King epoch. The Southern churches returned to their old ways after Reconstruction and blessed the new institutions of segregation and discrimination. It was not until after the Second World War and the spread of decolonization and human rights that the cry for emancipation was raised again. In response, it was again very forcefully asserted, on American soil, in the second half of the 20th century, that the discrepant descendants of Noah were not intended by God to be mixed. This barbaric stupidity had real-world consequences. The late Senator Eugene McCarthy told me that he had once urged Senator Pat Robertson, father of the present television prophet, to support some mild civil rights legislation. "I'd sure like to help the colored," came the response, "but the Bible says I can't." The entire self-definition of the South was that it was white and Christian. This is exactly what gave Dr. King his moral leverage, because he could outpreach the rednecks. But the heavy burden would never have been laid upon him if religiosity had not been so deeply entrenched to begin with. As Taylor Branch shows in his trilogy, many of King's inner circle and entourage were secular communists and socialists, who had been manuring the ground for a civil rights movement for several decades, and helping train brave volunteers like Mrs. Rosa Parks for a careful strategy of mass civil disobedience. And these atheistic associations were to be used against King all the time, especially from the pulpit. Indeed, one result of his campaign was to generate the backlash of white, right-wing Christianity, which is still such a potent force below the Mason-Dixon line. When Dr. King's namesake nailed his theses to the door of Wittenberg Cathedral in 1517 and stoutly announced, "Here I stand, I can do no other," he set a standard for intellectual and moral courage. But Martin Luther, who started his religious life being terribly frightened by a near-miss lightning strike, went on to become a bigot and a persecutor in his own right, railing murderously against Jews, screaming about demons, and calling on the German principalities to stamp on the rebellious poor. When Dr. King took a stand on the steps of Mr. Lincoln's memorial and changed history, he too adopted a position that had effectually been forced upon him. But he did so as a profound humanist, and nobody could ever use his name to justify oppression or cruelty. He endures for that reason, and his legacy has very little to do with his professed theology. No supernatural force was required to make the case against racism. Anybody, therefore, who uses the King legacy to justify the role of religion in public life must accept all the corollaries of what they seem to be implying. Even a glance at the whole record will show, first, that, person for person, American freethinkers and agnostics and atheists come out the best. The chance that someone's secular or free-thinking opinion would cause him or her to denounce the whole injustice was extremely high. The chance that someone's religious belief would cause him or her to take a stand against slavery and racism was statistically quite small. But the chance that someone's religious belief would cause him or her to uphold slavery and racism was statistically extremely high, and the latter fact helps us to understand why the victory of simple justice took so long to bring about. As far as I am aware, there is no country in the world today where slavery is still practiced, where the justification of it is not derived from the Quran. This returns us to the retort delivered in the very early days of the Republic to Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. These two slaveholders had called on the ambassador of Tripoli in London to ask him by what right he and his fellow Barbary potentates presumed to capture and sell American crews and passengers from ships using the Strait of Gibraltar. It is now estimated that between 1530 and 1780, more than 1.25 million Europeans were carried off in this way, as Jefferson reported to Congress. The ambassador answered us that it was founded on the laws of the Prophet, that it was written in their Quran, that all nations who should not have answered their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them whenever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners. Ambassador Abdurrahman went on to mention the requisite price of ransom, the price of protection from kidnapping, and last but not least, his own personal commission in these proceedings. Religion once again betrays its man-made conveniences. As it happens, he was quite right in what he said about the Quran. The 8th surah, revealed at Medina, deals at some length with the justified spoils of war and dwells continually on the further post-mortem torments of fire that await those who are defeated by the believers. It was this very surah that was to be used only 2 centuries later by Saddam Hussein to justify his mass murder and dispossession of the people of Kurdistan. Another grand historical episode, the emancipation of India from colonial rule, is often portrayed as though it involved a connection between religious belief and ethical outcomes. As with the heroic battle of Dr. King, the real story tends to show that something like the opposite is the case. After the critical weakening of the British Empire by the First World War, and most particularly after the notorious massacre of Indian protesters at the city of Amritsar in April 1919, it became apparent even to the then controllers of the subcontinent that rule from London would come to an end sooner rather than later. It was no longer a matter of if, but of when. Had this not been the case, a campaign of peaceful disobedience would have stood no chance. Thus Mohandas K. Gandhi, sometimes known as the Mahatma, in respect for his standing as a Hindu elder, was in a sense pushing at an open door. There is no dishonour in that, but it is exactly his religious convictions that make his legacy a dubious rather than a saintly one. To state the matter shortly, he wanted India to revert to a village-dominated and primitive spiritual society. He made power-sharing with Muslims much harder, and he was quite prepared to make hypocritical use of violence when he thought it might suit him. The whole question of Indian independence was interleaved with the question of unity. Would the former British Raj be reborn as the same country, with the same borders and territorial integrity, and yet still be called India? To this, a certain rugged faction of Muslims answered no. Under British rule, they had enjoyed some protection as a very large minority, not to say a privileged one. And they were not willing to exchange this state of affairs for becoming a large minority in a Hindu-dominated state. Thus, the sheer fact that the main force for independence, the Congress Party, was dominated by a conspicuous Hindu, made conciliation very difficult. It could be argued, and indeed I would argue, that Muslim intransigence would have played a destructive role in any case. But the task of persuading ordinary Muslims to leave Congress and join with the partitionist Muslim League was made much easier by Gandhi's talk of Hinduism and by the long, ostentatious hours he spent in cultish practices and in tending his spinning wheel. This wheel, which still appears as the symbol on the Indian flag, was the emblem of Gandhi's rejection of modernity. He took to dressing in rags of his own manufacture and sandals, and to carrying a staff and expressing hostility to machinery and technology. He rhapsodized about the Indian village, where the millennial rhythms of animals and crops would determine how human life was lived. Millions of people would have mindlessly starved to death if his advice had been followed, and would have continued to worship cows, cleverly denominated by the priests as sacred, so that the poor ignorant people would not kill and eat their only capital during times of drought and famine. Gandhi deserves credit for his criticism of the inhuman Hindu system of caste, whereby lower orders of humanity were condemned to an ostracism and contempt that was in some ways even more absolute and cruel than slavery. But at just the moment when what India most needed was a modern secular nationalist leader, it got a fakir and a guru instead. The crux of this unwelcome realization came in 1941, when the Imperial Japanese Army had conquered Malaya and Burma and was on the frontiers of India itself. Believing, wrongly, that this spelled the end of the Raj, Gandhi chose this moment to boycott the political process and issue his notorious call for the British to quit India. He added that they should leave it to God or to anarchy, which in the circumstances would have meant much the same thing. Those who naively credit Gandhi with a conscientious or consistent pacifism might wish to ask if this did not amount to letting the Japanese imperialists do his fighting for him. among the many bad consequences of the Gandhi Congress decision to withdraw from negotiations, was the opening it gave to Muslim League adherents to stay on in the state ministries which they controlled, and thus to enhance their bargaining positions when the moment for independence arrived shortly thereafter. Their insistence that independence take the form of mutilation and amputation, with western Punjab and eastern Bengal hacked away from the national body, became unstoppable. The hideous consequences endure to this day, with further Muslim-on-Muslim bloodbaths in Bangladesh in 1971, the rise of an aggressive Hindu nationalist party, and a confrontation in Kashmir that is still the likeliest provocation for a thermonuclear war. There was always an alternative in the form of the secular position taken by Nehru and Rajago Palachari, who would have traded a British promise of immediate post-war independence for a common alliance on the part of both India and Britain against fascism. In the event, it was in fact Nehru and not Gandhi who led his country to independence, even at the awful price of partition. For decades, a solid brotherhood between British and Indian secularists and leftists had laid out the case for, and won the argument for, the liberation of India. There was never any need for an obscurantist religious figure to impose his ego on the process and both retard and distort it. The whole case was complete without that assumption. One wishes every day that Martin Luther King had lived on and continued to lend his presence and his wisdom to American politics. For the Mahatma, who was murdered by members of a fanatical Hindu sect for not being devout enough, one wishes that he could have lived, if only to see what damage he'd wrought, and is relieved that he did not live to implement his ludicrous spinning wheel program. The argument that religious belief improves people, or that it helps to civilize society, is one that people tend to bring up when they have exhausted the rest of their case. Very well, they seem to say, we cease to insist on the Exodus, say, or the virgin birth, or even the resurrection, or the night flight from Mecca to Jerusalem. But where would people be without faith? Would they not abandon themselves to every kind of license and selfishness? Is it not true, as G.K. Chesterton once famously said, that if people cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing but in anything? The first thing to be said is that virtuous behaviour by a believer is no proof at all of, indeed is not even an argument for, the truth of his belief. I might, just for the sake of argument, act more charitably if I believed that Lord Buddha was born from a slit in his mother's side. But would not this make my charitable impulse dependent upon something rather tenuous? By the same token, I do not say that if I catch a Buddhist priest stealing all the offerings left by the simple folk at his temple, Buddhism itself is thereby discredited. And we forget in any case how contingent all this is. Of the thousands of possible desert religions there were, as with the millions of potential species there were, one branch happened to take root and grow. Passing through its Jewish mutations to its Christian form, it was eventually adopted for political reasons by the Emperor Constantine and made into an official faith with, eventually, a codified and enforceable form of its many chaotic and contradictory books. As for Islam, it became the ideology of a highly successful conquest that was adopted by successful ruling dynasties, codified and set down in its turn, and promulgated as the law of the land. One or two military victories the other way, as with Lincoln at Antietam, and we in the West would not be the hostages of village disputes that took place in Judea and Arabia before any serious records were kept. We could have become the votaries of another belief altogether, perhaps a Hindu or an Aztec or a Confucian one, in which case we should still be told that, strictly true or not, it nonetheless helped teach the children the difference between right and wrong. In other words, to believe in a god is in one way to express a willingness to believe in anything, whereas to reject the belief is by no means to profess belief in nothing. I once watched the late Professor A.J. Ayer, the distinguished author of Language, Truth, and Logic, and a celebrated humanist, debate with a certain Bishop Butler. The chairman was the philosopher Brian McGee. The exchange proceeded politely enough until the bishop, hearing Ayer assert that he saw no evidence at all for the existence of any god, broke in to say, "Then I cannot see why you do not lead a life of unbridled immorality." At this point, Freddy, as his friends knew him, abandoned his normal suave urbanity and exclaimed, "I must say that I think that's a perfectly monstrous insinuation." Now, Freddy had certainly broken most commandments respecting the sexual code as adumbrated from Sinai. He was, in a way, justly famous for this. But he was an excellent teacher, a loving parent, and a man who spent much of his spare time pressing for human rights and free speech. To say that his life was an immoral one would be a travesty of the truth. From the many writers who exemplify the same point in a different way, I shall select Evelyn Waugh, who was of the same faith as Bishop Butler, and who did his best in his fiction to argue for the operations of divine grace. In his novel Brideshead Revisited, he makes a very acute observation. The two protagonists, Sebastian Flight and Charles Ryder, the first of whom is heir to an old Catholic nobility, are visited by Father Phipps, who believes that all young men must be passionately interested in cricket. When disabused of this notion, he looks at Charles with the expression I have seen since in the religious, of innocent wonder that those who expose themselves to the dangers of the world should avail themselves so little of its varied solace. Thus I re-scrutinise Bishop Butler's question. Was he in fact not telling Eyre, in his own naive way, that if freed from the restraints of doctrine, he himself would choose to lead a life of unbridled immorality? One naturally hopes not, but much empirical evidence exists to reinforce the suggestion. When priests go bad, they go very bad indeed, and commit crimes that would make the average sinner pale. One might prefer to attribute this to sexual repression than to the actual doctrines preached, but then one of the actual doctrines preached is sexual repression. Thus the connection is unavoidable, and a litany of folkloric jokes have been told by all lay members of the church ever since religion began. War's own life was far more stained by offences against chastity and sobriety than was the life of Eyre, only it seemed to bring less happiness to the former than to the latter. And in consequence he was often asked how he reconciled his private conduct with his public beliefs. His reply has become celebrated. He asked his friends to imagine how much worse he would be if he were not a Catholic. For a believer in original sin, this might have served as a turning of the tables, but any examination of War's actual life shows that its most wicked elements arose precisely from his faith. Never mind the sad excesses of drunkenness and marital infidelity, he once sent a wedding telegram to a divorced and now remarried friend, telling her that her nuptial night would increase the loneliness of Calvary and add to the spittle on the face of Christ. He supported fascist movements in Spain and Croatia, and Mussolini's foul invasion of Abyssinia, because they enjoyed the support of the Vatican. And he wrote in 1944 that only the Third Reich now stood between Europe and barbarism. These deformities in one of my most beloved authors arose not in spite of his faith, but because of it. No doubt there were private acts of charity and contrition, but these could equally well have been performed by a person of no faith at all. To look no further than the United States, the great Colonel Robert Ingersoll, who was the nation's leading advocate of unbelief until his death in 1899, maddened his opponents because he was a person of immense generosity, a loving and constant husband and father, a gallant officer, and the possessor of what Thomas Edison with pardonable exaggeration called all the attributes of a perfect man. In my own recent life in Washington, I've been bombarded with obscene and menacing phone calls from Muslims, promising to punish my family because I do not support a campaign of lies and hatred and violence against democratic Denmark. But when my wife accidentally left a large amount of cash on the back seat of a taxi, the Sudanese cab driver went to a good deal of trouble and expense to work out whose property this was, and to drive all the way to my home to return it untouched. When I made the vulgar mistake of offering him 10% of the money, he made it quietly but firmly plain that he expected no recompense for performing his Islamic duty. Which of these two versions of faith is the one to rely upon? The question is in some ways ultimately undecidable. I would prefer to have Evelyn Waugh's shelf of writing just as it is, and to appreciate that one cannot have the novels without the torments and evils of its author. And if all Muslims conducted themselves like the man who gave up more than a week's salary in order to do the right thing, I could be quite indifferent to the weird exhortations of the Quran. If I search my own life for instances of good or fine behaviour, I am not overwhelmed by an excess of choice. I did once, shivering with fear, take off my flak jacket in Sarajevo and lend it to an even more frightened woman who I was helping escort to a place of safety. I am not the only one who has been an atheist in a foxhole. I felt at the time that it was the least I could do for her, as well as the most. The people shelling and sniping were Serbian Christians, but then so was she. In northern Uganda, in late 2005, I sat in a centre for the rehabilitation of kidnapped and enslaved children in the land of the Acholi people who live on the northern side of the Nile. The listless, vacant, hardened little boys and some girls were all around me. Their stories were distressingly similar. They had been seized at the age of anything from 8 to 13 from their schools or homes by a stone-faced militia that was itself originally made up of abducted children. Marched into the bush, they were initiated into the force by one or two of two methods. They either had to take part in a murder themselves in order to feel dirtied up and implicated, or they had to submit to a prolonged and savage whipping, often of up to 300 strokes. Children who have felt cruelty, said one of the editors of the Acholi people, know very well how to inflict it. The misery inflicted by this army of wretches turned zombies was almost beyond computation. It had razed villages, created a vast refugee population, committed hideous crimes such as mutilation and disemboweling, and, in a special touch of evil, had continued to kidnap children, so that the Acholi were wary of taking strong countermeasures lest they kill or injure one of their own. The name of the militia was the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, and it was led by a man named Joseph Kony, a passionate former altar boy who wanted to subject the area to the rule of the Ten Commandments. He baptized by oil and water, held fierce ceremonies of punishment and purification, and insured his followers against death. His was a fanatical preachment of Christianity. As it happened, the rehabilitation center in which I was sitting was also run by a fundamentalist Christian organization. Having been out into the bush and seen the work of the LRA, I fell to talking with the man who tried to repair the damage. How did he know, I asked him, which of them was the truest believer? Any secular or state-run outfit could be doing what he was doing, fitting prosthetic limbs and providing shelter and counseling. But in order to be Joseph Kony, one had to have real faith. To my surprise, he did not dismiss my question. It was true, he said, that Kony's authority arose in part from his background in a priestly Christian family. It was also true that people were apt to believe he could work miracles by appealing to the spirit world and promising his acolytes that they were death-proof. Even some of those who had run away would still swear that they had seen wonders performed by the man. All that a missionary could do was to try and show people a different face of Christianity. I was impressed by this man's frankness. There were some other defenses that he might have offered. Joseph Kony is obviously far away from the Christian mainstream. For one thing, his paymasters and armourers are the cynical Muslims of the Sudanese regime, who use him to make trouble for the government of Uganda, which has in turn supported rebel groups in Sudan. In an apparent reward for this support, Kony at one stage began denouncing the keeping and eating of pigs, which, unless he has become a fundamentalist Jew in his old age, suggests a payoff to his bosses. These Sudanese murderers, in their turn, have for years been conducting a war of extermination, not just against the Christians and animists of southern Sudan, but against the non-Arab Muslims of Darfur province. Islam may officially make no distinction between races and nations, but the slaughterers in Darfur are Arab Muslims, and their victims are African Muslims. The Lord's Resistance Army is nothing but a Christian Khmer Rouge sideshow in this more general horror. An even more graphic example is afforded by the case of Rwanda, which in 1992 gave the world a new synonym for genocide and sadism. This former Belgian possession is the most Christian country in Africa, boasting the highest percentage of churches per head of population, with 65% of Rwandans professing Roman Catholicism, and another 15% adhering to various Protestant sects. The words per head took on a macabre ring in 1992, when at a given signal the racist militias of Hutu power, incited by state and church, fell upon their Tutsi neighbours and slaughtered them en masse. This was no atavistic spasm of bloodletting, but a coldly rehearsed African version of the final solution, which had been in preparation for some time. The early warning of it came in 1987, when a Catholic visionary with the deceptively folksy name of Little Pebbles began to boast of hearing voices and seeing visions, these deriving from the Virgin Mary. The said voices and visions were distressingly bloody, predicting massacre and apocalypse, but also, as if in compensation, the return of Jesus Christ on Easter Sunday 1992. Apparitions of Mary, on a hilltop named Kibeho, were investigated by the Catholic Church and announced to be reliable. The wife of the Rwandan president, Agatha Habyarimana, was specially entranced by these visions and maintained a close relationship with the Bishop of Kigali, Rwanda's capital city. This man, Monsignor Vincent Nsengiyumva, was also a central committee member of President Habyarimana's single ruling party, the National Revolutionary Movement for Development, or NRMD. This party, together with other organs of state, was fond of rounding up any women of whom it disapproved as prostitutes, and of encouraging Catholic activists to trash any stores that sold contraceptives. Over time, the word spread that prophecy would be fulfilled and that the cockroaches, the Tutsi minority, would soon get what was coming to them. When the apocalyptic year of 1994 actually hit and the premeditated and coordinated massacres began, many frightened Tutsi and dissident Hutu were unwise enough to try and take refuge in churches. This made life considerably easier for the Interahamwe, or government and military death squads, who knew where to find them and who could rely on priests and nuns to point out the locations. This is why so many of the mass grave sites that have been photographed are on consecrated ground, and it is also why several clergymen and nuns are in the dock at the ongoing Rwandan genocide trials. The notorious Father Wenceslas Munyashyaka, for example, a leading figure at the Kigali Cathedral of Saint-Famille, was smuggled out of the country with the assistance of French priests, but he has since been charged with genocide, with providing lists of civilians to the Interahamwe, and with the rape of young refugee women. He's by no means the only cleric to have faced similar charges. Lest it be thought that he was merely a rogue priest, we have the word of another member of the Rwandan hierarchy, the Bishop of Gikongoro, otherwise known as Monsignor Augustin Misago. To quote one careful account of these atrocious events, Bishop Misago was often described as a Hutu power sympathizer. He had been publicly accused of barring Tutsis from places of refuge, criticizing fellow members of the clergy who helped cockroaches, and asking a Vatican emissary who visited Rwanda in June 1994 to tell a pope to find a place for Tutsi priests because the Rwandan people do not want them anymore. What's more, on May 4 of that year, shortly before the last Marian apparition at Kibeho, the bishop appeared there himself with a team of policemen and told a group of 90 Tutsi schoolchildren who were being held in preparation for slaughter not to worry, because the police would protect them. 3 days later, the police helped to massacre 82 of the children. Schoolchildren held in preparation for slaughter. Perhaps you remember the Pope's denunciation of this ineffaceable crime, and of the complicity of his church in it? Or perhaps you do not, since no such comment was ever made. Paul Rusesabagina, the hero of Hotel Rwanda, remembers Father Wenceslas Munyashaka referring even to his own Tutsi mother as a cockroach. But this did not prevent him, before his arrest in France, from being allowed by the French church to resume his pastoral duties. As for Bishop Misago, there were those in the post-war Rwandan Ministry of Justice who felt that he should be charged as well. But as one of the officials of the ministry phrased it, "The Vatican is too strong and too unapologetic for us to go taking on bishops. Haven't you heard of infallibility?" At a minimum, this makes it impossible to argue that religion causes people to behave in a more kindly or civilized manner. The worse the offender, the more devout he turns out to be. It can be added that some of the most dedicated relief workers are also believers, though as it happens the best ones I have met are secularists who are not trying to proselytize for any faith. But the chance that a person committing the crimes was faith-based was almost 100%, while the chances that a person of faith was on the side of humanity and decency were about as good as the odds of a coin flip. Extend this back into history and the odds become more like those of an astrological prediction that just happens to come true. This is because religions could never have got started, let alone thrived, unless for the influence of men as fanatical as Moses or Muhammad or Joseph Kony. While charity and relief work, while they may appeal to tender-hearted believers, are the inheritors of modernism and the Enlightenment. Before that, religion was spread not by example, but as an auxiliary to the more old-fashioned methods of holy war and imperialism. I was a guarded admirer of the late Pope John Paul II, who by any human standards was a brave and serious person, capable of displaying both moral and physical courage. He helped the anti-Nazi resistance in his native country as a young man, and in later life did much to assist its emancipation from Soviet rule. His papacy was in some ways shockingly conservative and authoritarian, but showed itself open to science and inquiry, except when the AIDS virus was under discussion, and even in its dogma about abortion made some concessions to a life ethic, which, for example, began to teach that capital punishment was almost always wrong. On his death, Pope John Paul was praised, among other things, for the number of apologies he had made. These did not include, as they should have done, an atonement for the million or so put to the sword in Rwanda. However, they did include an apology to the Jews for the centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, an apology to the Muslim world for the Crusades, an apology to Eastern Orthodox Christians for the many persecutions that Rome had inflicted upon them too, and some general contrition about the Inquisition as well. This seemed to say that the Church had mainly been wrong and often criminal in the past, but was now purged of its sin by confession and quite ready to be infallible all over again.